Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. The CDC reports Wisconsin's COVID-19 positivity rate is just shy of 20%, with Marathon and Eau Claire counties listed as a high risk. Meanwhile, a new virus, monkeypox, is spreading across the country. The federal government has declared it a public health emergency. 32 cases have been confirmed in Wisconsin since it was first reported in the state last month. However, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has just approved a new method of administering the limited supply of vaccines with the hope of stopping further spread. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation and ask your own questions by calling 800-780-9742, or you can send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. Today, we welcome back Dr. Jonathan Tempte to guide us through the latest information on COVID-19 research, subvariants, and what we need to know about monkeypox. Dr. Tempte is an expert in vaccines and immunization policy, and he's the Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Tempte, welcome back to Route 51.
Well, thank you so much, Rick, for the invitation this morning, and hopefully we can answer some questions out there.
That would be great. Thank you so much for being here. Starting off today, we'd like to talk about the latest on COVID-19. Dr. Tempte, is the current stage of the BA5 subvariant preventing the virus from reaching endemic status anytime soon?
Well, I think we're pretty much at this point of transition between what we call a pandemic and endemic. And to be perfectly honest, there's no standard definition or point in time that we say, oh, you know, we're now in endemic. It's more associated when we as a society are comfortable with what we're seeing out there. And I think to answer your question, the BA5 has been very effective in easy transmission. And fortunately, it has not been associated with increased problems in terms of hospitalization and deaths. So this is part of what we're living with right now. And unfortunately, the BA5 and also BA4 predecessor are viruses that escape a lot of our prior immunity. And so I think the take home for most people out there is this is something we're going to learn to live with. This is something that we're going to see very likely causing reinfection year after year after year.
Well, last month, speaking of this, last month, the Washington Post reported that antibodies from vaccines and previous coronavirus infections offer limited protection against BA5. And they quoted pandemic researcher Eric Topol, who said, it is the worst version of the virus that we've seen. How effective, really, now are the current vaccines against BA5?
Excellent question, and it really depends on what you're looking at. So the vaccines have not been as effective as we would like in preventing infection, but they're pretty good about preventing symptomatic infection. They're very good about preventing hospitalization and severe COVID, and they're excellent for preventing death. And so I think the take-home message here is that vaccination is still a key tool in our public health and our medical armamentarium to prevent the bad outcomes. That being said, also prior exposure to the virus, so being previously infected, provides good protection as well. And what we know is what we call hybrid immunity, so being vaccinated and having a prior infection or a future infection provides really robust. So I think the long and short of it is, yeah, this is a very infectious virus, but we're not seeing as much of the negative severe consequences that we did before. And as we move forward in terms of public health and medical policy, we have to kind of shift from a theory or an approach to preventing infection to preventing the bad outcomes.
So are there any BA-specific vaccines being developed now or being researched?
Yes, there are. So I think within the next few months, we're going to be seeing a rollout of vaccines that are either an Omicron specific or an Omicron original type mixture in the vaccine that will provide a broader response in the immune system to what's out there. So I have to emphasize that we know that vaccination will prevent a lot of the significant outcomes. And as we move forward, and you know, when we start talking about, well, where are we going to be in a year, 2 years, and 5 years, this is still kind of up in the air in terms of, are we going to see an annual vaccine? Are we going to see a vaccine that's every 2 years? I don't know yet. But it's very likely that we're going to have to constantly be updating this vaccine. But we have a model for that. This is what we do every year with the influenza vaccine. Our current vaccines have four different types and subtypes of influenza. And each and every year, these are updated to match what is likely going to be in circulation.
What do you say to people that are still skeptical about vaccines, this one particularly?
Well, yeah, the bottom line is now we have a good, I'm trying to think, 20 months of experience with this vaccine. This is a vaccine that has gone into billions of people across the world, and it has been incredibly safe as a vaccine platform. We just do not see a lot of concerns emerging. And the ones that have emerged, various groups from CDC to our state health department have been very open in terms of what those side effects are. At the same time, we've seen that the vaccines have been very, very effective in terms of prevention of hospitalization, severe outcomes, and of death. And the data and the evidence is irrefutable out there for that benefit. So I think going forward, people may be aware of recently updated guidelines from CDC in terms of how we're going to be moving into the fall. And the first and foremost part of that is the importance of vaccines. So I think this is going to be part of that. Unfortunately, here in Wisconsin, about a third of our state, a third of our individuals have not gotten a single dose yet. And the effect has been very apparent. We see that is the group that has the most significant effects in terms of hospitalization and death, even now.
Well, you mentioned the CDC guidelines changing and adapting to the current trends of what we're seeing with positive tests and negative tests and so on. But the question about isolation really seems to be confusing to a lot of folks right now, because we're getting, seem to be getting differing recommendations. CDC guidelines right now don't require someone with COVID test, positive test, to end their isolation. But some health officials say that people should have a negative rapid test before ending the isolation. Why is there such disagreement between the CDC and other folks in what you do every day?
Well, I think you hit upon it perfectly at the very beginning of our conversation, talking about moving from pandemic to endemic. And at one point, we have to pull the switch and say, you know, we're not able to control the spread of this virus. What we are able to do is control the severe effects of it. And so the guidelines right now in terms of isolation would indicate that if you're positive, you should stay home until, you know, a fever breaks, until you have a negative test. But after 5 days, you could go out wearing a high quality mask. And so I think the realization is over the first 2 years, we put in a lot of effort in terms of case identification, contact tracing, and so on. And ultimately, that did not work very well. I'll be the first to admit it. This is, I picture this as trying to plug individual holes in a sieve. You just don't have the ability and the resources to have full containment. And I think the realization at this point of time is this is a virus out here. It's going to become our fifth seasonal coronavirus. It's going to be in circulation. And at this point in time, how do we approach this to protect the people who are most vulnerable? And so this is going to be older individuals, people with multiple medical problems, people with immunocompromise, and so on. And how do we protect these individuals as best as we can?
We're talking with Dr. Jonathan Tempte from the University of Wisconsin about recent updates in COVID, COVID policy, vaccinations, and so on. If you'd like to join the conversation, please call us at 800-780-9742. Now, we've been experiencing, at least I've been experiencing, a lot of folks that have pandemic fatigue, and I'm sure you're experiencing that as well, as are many people throughout our state and beyond. The fall sporting season is coming up. Crowds are going to be gathered at Lambeau, and they're going to be gathered at Camp Randall and other places. We just don't hear a lot about COVID much anymore, even though the numbers are rising. The positivity rates are seemingly rising. What are you saying to people as they get ready to gather for these kinds of events, family reunions still happening at the end of the summer?
Well, I think kind of the first thing to think about right now is today, 400 people in the United States will die of COVID. And yesterday, 400 people. And on average, we're accumulating about 3,000 deaths a week. This is unprecedented. You know, I've spent my career studying influenza. And in a really bad influenza year, we might hit levels like that. But we're doing this at kind of a low period. So the take home is do everything you can to protect yourself, protect those people around you. And the single best thing we have is vaccination. If you're ill, if you're coughing, sneezing, and so on, acutely ill, don't go to the sporting event. Don't go to the birthday party, the family reunion, and so on. And, you know, be liberal with the testing. You know, we have a lot of testing capacity out there right now. But the other thing to keep in mind is as we gather more and more in the coming weeks and months, you know, school is starting, the university is starting, people are having the pandemic fatigue. I'm guilty of that as well. As we move forward, keep in mind that SARS-CoV-2, you know, the agent for COVID-19, is one of dozens of respiratory viruses out there that are just waiting for us to gather together. And so come this fall, especially when kids get back into school, universities open, we're not only going to see rises in COVID-19, but we're going to see the common cold, rhinovirus. We're going to see parainfluenza. We'll see influenza out there and all this other assortment of common respiratory viruses. And the confusing part is we won't know what we're sick with. And right now we're used to testing for COVID-19. People will do that test and go, well, I don't think I have that, but I have something else. And all those things are equally or are transmitted in a similar way, droplets and sneezing and coughing. So again, I think the most important thing is vaccination. And if you're sick, staying home.
Just a couple of weeks ago, President Joe Biden got COVID, tested positive. Then he had a rare rebound case. Please explain what that means. What is the rebound case of COVID?
Well, President Biden was treated with a chemical or a drug called Paxlovid. It's an antiviral, which is the most commonly used antiviral now for COVID-19. And we know that early application of this drug really not only prevents severe COVID and prevents death, but it also makes people feel better faster. Unfortunately, there's something called Paxlovid rebound. When we pull that drug away, a lot of people, probably somewhere in the range of 10 to 15%, will start having mild symptoms again and might actually pop up with tests becoming positive. And think of it as the drug is greatly suppressing the ability of this virus to reproduce itself. You pull it away, it can regain some of that function. What we tend to find is lower levels of virus. We tend to find very mild symptoms, if symptoms at all. But keeping in mind that if you have virus present, particularly on a rapid test, you're still potentially contagious to somebody else. So this is why it's really important, if you're treated with a drug, when you're done with it, to be aware of the possibility of it popping back.
Okay, thank you for that. You're listening to Dr. Jonathan Tempte on Route 51. We're talking about the latest information on the COVID-19 pandemic. Coming up, we turn to the monkeypox virus. What exactly is it? And what's in place to stop to stop the spread? We'll answer your questions as well when you call us at 800-780-9742. Again, that's 800-780-9742. You can send us an email as well to ideas at WPR.org. I'm Rick Ryer. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Route 51 on the Ideas Network. I'm Rick Ryer. Dr. Jonathan Tempte is with us today as we turn our attention to the monkeypox virus. What would you like to know? Email us at ideas@wpr.org or join us by phone. The number is 800-780-9742. Dr. Tempte, what have health officials learned from the COVID-19 pandemic that can help us as monkeypox spreads?
Boy, that is a loaded question, Ike, I have to admit. To be honest, I think an awful lot of people in public health and laboratory science are suffering from, as you mentioned earlier, the pandemic fatigue. That being said, we have a good system of understanding, a good system of figuring out what to do. We've been under a pandemic drill for the last 2.5 years, and we can't really describe monkeypox as a pandemic as of yet, but it certainly is a global health emergency that we have to kind of have a all hands on deck approach to trying to understand as quickly as we can this newly emerged virus. I'll just, you know, take a step back and say we've known about monkeypox since 1958, originally found in two colonies of research monkeys that had skin lesions, and hence the name monkeypox. But it's not spread from monkeys to people. This is typically a rodent to human transmission. And in fact, the last time we saw monkeypox, and the only other time we've seen it in the United States, is going back to 2003. And Wisconsin was our epicenter in the United States for monkeypox. We had more cases than any other state. But these would be transmitted from prairie dogs to humans. And the prairie dogs had been infected in a wild or in a pet trade center from some rodents from Ghana, Africa. And so fortunately, that was a very curtailed, a very short outbreak with very little or without any human-to-human transmission. So this is something very different right now.
Well, so when does it make sense to compare how we respond to these two health situations? And in what cases and what areas should we avoid drawing these conclusions?
Well, I think the first thing is a comparison of how transmittable monkeypox is compared to COVID-19. And if we look at the accumulating data, some of the indicators would be that monkeypox is far less transmittable, and it is what I'd say less efficient at transmission. For example, a close contact for COVID-19 would be sitting, you know, within 6 feet of somebody who's positive for 15 minutes. And with monkeypox, we're looking at, you know, I believe 6 hours within a case for the possible respiratory transmission. That being said, this is a virus that now is being transmitted almost entirely by close skin-to-skin contact between an infected person and somebody who's not infected. But that brings up another really important component here. With SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19, at the beginning, none of us were immune. And as it turns out that with monkeypox at the beginning, virtually none of us starts out being immune. That might be a little bit off because those of us old enough to have a smallpox vaccine lesion up on our upper arm probably have some immunity toward this. But we have to put in context that we're introducing this virus into a sea of people who don't have immunity. And that opens the door to easy spread. However, the easiness is on a real big spectrum. And I'd say that COVID-19 is one of the most transmittable viruses out there, and monkeypox is way, way up the scale.
Okay. You talked about similarities to smallpox. You know, it's milder in terms of the effect of monkeypox. What symptoms should people be looking for if they believe they might have monkeypox?
Excellent question. So first and foremost, monkeypox has an incubation period that averages about 7 days. So from the time you're exposed until the time that you have first symptoms is about a week. First symptoms tend to be very general in nature. So think about fever, tiredness, maybe achiness, swollen lymph nodes, and so on. On average, it's about a day after those initial symptoms come on, but it could be as many as 4 or 5 days, is the onset of a rash. And in the characteristic monkeypox, this is a rash that starts out kind of as spots that move into bumps, or what we call papules, that turn into blisters, that turn into sores, that scab over, and that eventually slough off. That whole process might take upwards to 4 weeks or so on. And the thing to keep in mind is from the time of first symptoms, that fever, the headache, you know, achiness and so on, until the very last lesion is crusted over and replaced by normal skin, you're considered contagious. So unlike COVID, this has a really, really long period of contagiousness. But again, there are things that we can do.
Now, you mentioned that skin-to-skin, prolonged skin-to-skin contact as the way this this virus spreads. And does it live on surfaces, as we did learn about COVID back when that was first being researched and came out? And if it does live on surfaces, how long?
Excellent question. And the jury is still out, okay?
Okay.
We have to be careful about getting ahead of the evidence. There have been some publications out there that will suggest that monkeypox can stay on surfaces for a prolonged time. And even within CDC guidance, they're talking about possibility of viable virus for days and weeks on a surface. But I think what we want to keep in mind is the amount and what we're doing. And so, for example, somebody who has hundreds of lesions, one could consider things like bed sheets really infected, and then you have to be very, very careful. With a current outbreak right now in the U.S. and across the globe, we're finding some of the features are different than the classic monkeypox, and people are finding fewer lesions, not as widespread, and possibly easier to cover and prevent from getting onto everything. So what I worry about, to some extent, are people become overly concerned about surfaces. If you remember back in the early days of COVID-19, a lot of people were not going to the grocery store. They'd have groceries delivered, and the groceries would sit out in the garage for 24 to 48 hours before they'd come in. Totally unnecessary. It turns out that, you know, this was not an efficient way of spread. The bottom line here is the way that monkeypox is spreading 98-99% of the time is due to close skin-to-skin contact with somebody who has active monkeypox. And as of today, in the United States, 98% of the cases have been in men who have sex with men. And if you can think about that, we have prolonged skin-to-skin contact. And that really is the take-home message here, that we're not seeing it breaking into other populations. You know, across the entire United States with almost 11,000 cases, I believe we've had 3 cases in children. Having cases outside of this initial group have been rare. Will that happen? Absolutely. We'll see more and more of that. But I don't think we're going to see the potential for this kind of running away and exploding on us.
I was going to ask you about that and that specific statistic and what you had said. Now, LGBTQ advocates are concerned about the messaging here when monkeypox is really a threat, as you mentioned, to anyone, not just men who have sex with men. How do you explain this connection? How concerned are you that people who aren't gay men will see those initial headlines and think they're safe from monkeypox? It's not going to happen.
Yeah, so I think so much is in the education and messaging. And I think one of the worst things we can do is to stigmatize monkeypox and to make it less likely that people who have the possibility, based on their symptoms and exposure, to come in and be seen in our medical settings. You know, the key is early detection, early diagnosis, early education about what to do. And the more we make that kind of stigmatizing, the less likely we are to get good compliance with people coming in. So that's really important.
Do you see...
Go ahead. I was going to say, on our college campuses, we're starting to explore what happens this fall when we have the possibility of students that might have, what do you do in terms of isolation? What do you do in terms of quarantine? And how do you do that in a very respectful and appropriate manner where, again, we're not stigmatizing? So a lot of thought is going into that right now.
Well, do you see any parallels between the way we're talking about monkeypox and the AIDS crisis?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is where early on there has been a lack of full responsiveness to the needs, especially in our gay, bisexual, men who have sex with men communities, that the deployment of appropriate testing, of availability of vaccine has been limited. And even though we have an FDA-licensed vaccine that we can use for monkeypox, the supplies have been hard to get to. There are a number of stories about individuals with early monkeypox who cannot get the attention of their physicians or physicians in urgent care or emergency room. Even when they're told, I think I have monkeypox, people go, no, it's probably some other sexually transmitted disease or something like that. So I think we have to educate our medical workforce, our healthcare workforce, our public health. We have to educate the general public. And this is why I think programs like this are really, really important, getting the word out.
One of the things that we did see early on, especially in the COVID pandemic and as it first came out, was that folks that were already immunocompromised were at higher risk. Is that the same or similar to those related to the monkeypox virus?
In general, anybody who has an immunocompromising condition with a virus or other infectious disease will have a worse outcome. We don't have those immune defenses that are crucial to our body's response to the exposure and limiting the effect of a viral infection. So in the case of monkeypox, people who are immunocompromised really are appropriate for early and aggressive antiviral treatment. Again, even though there are no FDA-licensed antivirals for monkeypox, there is one out there under the name TPOX, which is licensed for use in smallpox. Because these viruses are very closely related, we think it has fairly good efficacy for monkeypox. So those are people that should be treated aggressively and early.
Dr. Jonathan Tempty is our guest today on Route 51 as we continue our discussion on monkeypox. We'd like to hear from you. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can also send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Rick Ryer. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us on Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer. Our guest today is Dr. Jonathan Tempte, an expert in vaccines and immunization policy, for a look at the emerging science around monkeypox. What would you like to know? Email us at ideas@wpr.org or join us by phone. The number to call is 800-780-9742. Dr. Tempte, one of the challenges with the COVID-19 virus is that some people have had the virus and been able to spread the virus, but they don't have any obvious symptoms. Can monkeypox spread among people who are asymptomatic?
Well, this is another very good question, and the answer is we are not sure. What we can say is that compared to what's considered the classic monkeypox, we're seeing people with a wide range. And I think I mentioned previously, there are individuals who will have one or two or a small number of lesions versus hundreds to thousands of lesions. Also, people may not have very severe early symptoms such as a fever, headache, and so on. So we are really early in the course here. Our very first case in the United States out of this outbreak was May 17th. And this has been ongoing since about 2017 in Nigeria. But again, the sheer number of cases have been pretty low. So suffice to say that we are always in the process of learning from what we're seeing, what we're experiencing. And our duty is to try and accumulate as much information as quickly as possible and get good factual and accurate information out to the general public as quickly as possible. But one has to be really careful about making assumptions and putting out wrong information. So this is where the whole medical research, public health research infrastructure is so very, very important. And I'll say at the same time, we've, despite the pandemic in this country, we have really diminished our capacity in public health to respond to things like this. And especially coming out of the pandemic, our public health workforce is exhausted. They have been put upon, they have been threatened, and so on. And this is really a crisis situation.
Well, one of the promising pieces of news that we came across is that this week, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration issued emergency authorization to allow healthcare providers to administer a smaller dose of the current vaccine used to prevent monkeypox. Talk to us about this vaccine and this new procedure.
Yeah, so there are two licensed vaccines that can be used for monkeypox. One called ACAM2000, which is basically our smallpox vaccine, and the second one called Jennios. And this is the one that they're talking about. Jennios is a safer vaccine. It's a live virus, but it doesn't reproduce in your body. And it's a two-dose vaccine. But what we're finding is that instead of injecting it under the skin, if we inject it into the skin, called an intradermal injection, it creates a much more potent immune response. And because of that, the FDA has reviewed evidence, information, and determined that the vaccine is still effective if you give only 20% or 1/5 of a dose in this within the skin injection or the intradermal. The good news is that automatically expands our vaccine supply by a factor of 5. And right now, it's really, really important early on to try and contain this as much as we can. So, for example, if you look at the state of Wisconsin, we recommend this vaccine to people who have a known exposure, who have been at an event where monkeypox has been identified, or is male with who has sex with men who has multiple sex partners. These are all higher risk, and this allows us to get more vaccine out into these higher risk populations. The other good news I'll just have to toss out is that if you give vaccine within 4 days of exposure, you can prevent monkeypox from occurring. If we give it within the first 14 days, so basically between day 4 and day 14, we can substantially lower and reduce the severity of an outbreak.
Well, from what I understand, that the smallpox vaccine really isn't safe for everyone, including the immunocompromised and those who are pregnant. What is the difference between that original vaccine and the new one, Jennios, as you described?
Excellent question. So that original vaccine and the one we have now for smallpox called ACAM2000 is a live vaccinia. It's not the smallpox virus, but it's a related virus. But it's a live virus that replicates and reproduces in your system. And when we give that to an individual, quite often what we'll find is a small outbreak of lesions right in that area of injection. But people who have immunocompromised, individuals who have really severe skin problems called eczema, this can take off and cause really, really severe problems. The other vaccine called Jennios is a live virus, but it does not reproduce. It does not replicate. And so it's far, far safer. We don't have to worry about those effects in individuals who are immunocompromised or have other problems with their skin.
What should someone do if they suspect they are sick but really don't know for sure with monkeypox? How early can you get tested?
Well, you can get tested actually quite early on. The current diagnosis is based on a swab off one of the lesions. And it could be at any stage of that lesion. We use a dry synthetic swab, so Dacron, nylon, or so on. But it just gets rubbed over the surface of the swab. And that can go into either a dry vial or a vial of something we call viral transport medium. These are things that are available in most clinical settings. But I think if you're suspecting, we don't have any testing officially before somebody has a skin lesion. So it's predicated on having a skin lesion. But if you think that there might be an exposure and you have a new lesion, this is the time that we want to have a lot of negative results. We want to be oversampling so we catch the rare case. So if people are concerned, call your doctor. If your doctor is unaware, make contact with your public health department. An awful lot, you know, I'm a family physician by training. I still see patients in clinic. And what I can say is many of my colleagues don't have up-to-date information on all these new emerging things. But it's really important for doctors out there, for nurse practitioners, physician assistants, to be in touch with their public health department so we have the most efficient way of sampling and getting that specimen transferred to where it should go for diagnosis. I know our Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene is doing a lot of testing right now. They're a world-class public health laboratory and a wonderful resource we have in the state.
No, you've talked about the monkeypox lesion quite a bit, actually. That's, you know, how you can tell you might have it. How does a person tell the difference between a monkeypox lesion and what could be body acne? Are they markedly different?
Yeah. So I think the main thing with like an acne tends to be much more chronic. You'll have lesions at all different stages and so on. And somebody coming into the clinic won't suddenly overnight start having crops of new lesions. So I think the timing is important. That characteristically, the monkeypox lesion tends to be a firm lesion. It tends to have a really defined boundary. Early on, it might have a little bit of a dimple in the middle of it. It will progress from that into a blister type, or what we call a vesicle. And then vesicles tend to open up, scab over, and so on. So it has this whole evolution in appearance over time. But at the same time, I'll just say, if people are concerned, if they're worried, it's reasonable to get that testing done. Right now, just for a reminder, we have 31 cases in Wisconsin. We haven't seen community spread at all. This has largely been within a fairly narrow community of men who have sex with men. But we'll start seeing more and more cases as time goes on. I'm hoping that we don't continue seeing the upswing that we're doing. And in fact, I think across the country, we've seen the rapidity of increase slow down a little bit. So fingers are crossed.
We're talking with Dr. Jonathan Tempe from the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And the conversation is about, right now, monkeypox, that virus, as well as COVID-19 and the updates and subvariants related to that. Join the conversation at 800-780-9742. Again, that's 800-780-9742. The flu season, we can't forget about that, is coming up. It's generally happening in the fall. Tell us about what you're seeing and preparing for as we go ahead and reach the flu season.
Well, influenza is a regular visitor to Wisconsin, something that I've worked with most of my career. And typically, our flu season is December through March. When we had schools shut down in March of 2020, influenza pretty much went away, and it's largely stayed away until now. Conversation this morning with our state influenza coordinator, surveillance coordinator, indicates that, you know, every week we're seeing about 5 or 6 cases right now. That's not unusual. But what we're worried about is, without having flu around for the last couple of years, that we open the door for a big season this year, particularly as we stepped away from those public health measures such as masking, distancing, and so on. What we saw in the Southern Hemisphere, which is, you know, 6 months different from us, is that Australia and South Africa, New Zealand, Argentina, for example, had really significant flu outbreaks occurring very, very early. So they were seeing this in April. That's equivalent to us seeing a flu outbreak in October, for example, which is incredibly early. So we're going to really be putting a lot of effort into early surveillance, looking for the appearance of influenza. And in the same breath, I'll say, we're going to be seeing a lot of activity of all those other viruses come in. So my take home for our listening audience is, flu shots are now available. Go out, get your flu shot, because it's, from what we're seeing across the Southern Hemisphere, it's a really good match with the vaccine this year.
Get the flu shot. That's your message.
Perfect. And get it early. Yep.
One of the other things that's really of particular interest in our area, especially for those of us that are out in the woods quite a bit, is the possibility of developing a Lyme disease vaccine that may be available as early as 2025. Is there anything you can tell us about that you've been seeing?
Well, yeah, first and foremost, this is really interesting. We used to have an effective Lyme vaccine made by one of the manufacturers, and they withdrew it because there wasn't enough interest in the vaccine. So now we're seeing another one come aboard. And in the ensuing 20 years, what we have seen with a changing climate and our summers warmer, that the tick, the Ixodes scapularis tick, which is the vehicle by which Lyme disease is transmitted, has exploded across the upper Midwest and the Northeast. And so now there's a great deal of interest in Lyme. There's been a lot of attention toward Lyme disease. And in fact, people have now been recruited to the phase 3 trials, which are the last step to generate information on safety and effectiveness of a vaccine before it goes to the FDA for licensure. So we're looking probably at having a product available, as you said, as early as 2025. And as someone who's been in practice for a long time in Wisconsin, what I've seen is I practice in Madison, is it used to be that we didn't see Lyme disease south of the Wisconsin River, and that's no longer the case. We see a lot of Lyme everywhere. So this is going to be something else in our toolbox that's going to be helpful for a number of our patients.
We talked about what may be ahead as we head into the cooler months. What advice do you have for people looking ahead to the fall when we'll be indoors much more into the winter? And anxiety might be a little high with pretty much every little sniffle or sneeze.
Yeah, well, first and foremost, we are all going to come down with respiratory infections this winter. I can almost guarantee this. And we're going to have a very generous and wide platter of possible viruses, from influenza to COVID-19 or SARS to the common cold virus. And I think the two messages I have are one, for the things that we can be vaccinated against for protection, SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19 and influenza, get those. And at the same time, if you're coming down with something, have the courtesy to stay at home. And if you have to go out, this is a good time to, if you're symptomatic, wearing a mask, because that's going to protect those people around you.
You know, especially when we're heading back to school, and you talked a little bit about this earlier, what's normal for kids? How often is it normal for the average child to pick up a respiratory infection?
Well, children are the most commonly affected by respiratory viruses. So influenza, most commonly transmitted in school-aged children. For kids in daycare, and, you know, kids in the first 2 years of life, I tend to think that they have typically 5 to 6 respiratory infections per year. When we get to the older grades, you know, typically it's 2 to 4 infections per year. But that's a lot of time spent with a runny nose, a cough, and so on. For adults, it really depends on our exposure to children. And so school teachers will tell you that especially the first 2 or 3 years they're teaching, they're sick all the time. Parents will tend to get sick. People who don't have much exposure to kids don't get sick all that often. But yeah, this is part of what's been described as the microbial sea in which we swim. And we're constantly being exposed to all sorts of things out there.
Final question for this morning, Dr. Tempte. We did talk about isolation. We haven't heard much about herd immunity as we did in the early stages of COVID-19. Has extended isolation wiped out that possibility?
Well, I think the wild card we had early on when we talked about herd immunity was the variants that came along. And we have had successive waves of viruses that have been more and more and more transmittable. And currently, the BA5 is incredibly transmittable. And that has made challenges. So when we first had a vaccine that was really highly effective, we saw the window open for this thing called herd immunity or herd effect. Unfortunately, that closed pretty quickly as we had the Alpha, the Delta, the Omicron variants come through. This is a really cagey virus that is able to change very rapidly and escape that immunity. So I think no one is really seriously talking about herd immunity at this point in time, but we're talking in terms of how do we learn to live with this virus.
Thank you. You're listening to Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer, extending a sincere thank you to our guest, Dr. Jonathan Tempte. Our producers today are Joy Retch-Kramer, Keely Bultina, and Kate Springer. Joy is our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program, as well as all of our previous programs at wpr.org/Route 51. If you have any ideas for a future program, you email us at ideas at www.thecitychurch.org. We'd love to hear from you. Next week, we'll be back with another fascinating discussion, and we'll hope you'll join us. Until then, we're headed out of town.